psychiatric sequelae from war trauma. This talk is going to focus on the most common one, which is post-traumatic stress disorder. So a semi-official estimate that comes from the National Center for PTSD is that we expect 12 to 20% of the returning veterans from Iraq to have a post-traumatic stress disorder. For a number of reasons, this may be a conservative figure. As of this summer, 1.5 million unique deployments had occurred. So 20% of 1,500,000 is 300,000 psychiatric casualties. That's what we're looking at. As of this summer also, 52,000 had already been treated for PTSD by the VA. And this number is expected to go up considerably. It's a smaller number, both because it's hard to get people to come in to see the doctor, and because PTSD has an insidious and often delayed onset. The official symptoms, 17 symptoms of PTSD, it's a bewildering array of symptoms. The first group is re-experiencing symptoms. These are the memories, nightmares, flashbacks. Physiologic and psychological distress that are triggered by reminders of the trauma. The second group is avoidant symptoms. Isolation, withdrawal, emotional numbing, detachment from others, gaps in your memory. The third group is hyperarousal, or what we can think of as too much adrenaline symptoms. Not being able to sleep, irritability, outbursts of anger, inability to concentrate, being especially watchful or on guard all the time, and having an exaggerated startle response. Beyond those official 17 symptoms, there are a number of important associated features of PTSD. Depression with suicidal ideation. Alcohol and drug abuse is very common in the Vietnam cohort. A full 70% of combat vets with PTSD had a full-blown substance abuse disorder at some point in time. Inevitably, people have issues with guilt and shame and inability to trust others. Everybody with PTSD has some degree of trust issues. They may have few or no close relationships and be extremely isolated. We see one of the largest numbers of in our clinic in the Northwest. There's a lot of people literally hiding in the woods. So we see more than most places in the country. Unemployment, divorce, domestic violence, child abuse. Quote from Jonathan Shea, who's written the terrific books Achilles in Vietnam and Odysseus in America. He's a VA psychiatrist. Untreated PTSD can devastate life and incapacitate its victims from participation in the domestic, economic, and political life of the nation. The painful paradox is that fighting for one's country can render one unfit to be its citizen. Couple of quick facts about suicide. In 2006, the suicide rate in the U.S. Army was the highest that it's ever recorded in the 26 years that it's been keeping records. Secondly, a recent study looking at veterans of all wars going back to World War I demonstrated that veterans of all wars are twice as likely to die of suicide as non-veterans in the general population. I would like to talk a little bit about what are the factors that make it more likely for someone to get PTSD. And there are factors related to the trauma itself and factors in the environment of the person both before and after the traumatic events. the nature of the trauma itself, the most important factor is the intensity and the duration of the trauma. So in other words, there's a dose response effect. Significant object loss, meaning loss of a loved one. Human design versus accident. Intense interpersonal traumas, like sexual assault trauma or combat trauma, are far more likely to produce PTSD than things that would be considered like an act of God, like a fire or a flood or a motor vehicle accident even. So there's something critical about that interpersonal component. In rape trauma, if you know the perpetrator, if there's a weapon involved, or if there's physical injury, you're more likely to get PTSD. In combat trauma, if there's witnessing or participating in atrocities, or civilian casualties or friendly fire, you're more likely to get PTSD. These are things that haunt people for the rest of their lives. Factors before the trauma include pathology in the family unit, particularly child abuse, makes it more likely for you to get PTSD. The younger you are, the more likely you are to get PTSD. So it doesn't bode well that we send our children off to war. And gender is important. Many studies have consistently shown that given exposure to the same traumas, women are about twice as likely as men to get PTSD. And factors also in the environment after the trauma, including the response and the nature of the welcome home. Anything that re-traumatizes the individual can bring all the symptoms back. And oftentimes, anytime anybody has to deal with either doctors or lawyers, tends to cause their PTSD to act up. Other psychiatric and medical conditions. And one factor that is of grave psychiatric concern currently are the unprecedented multiple deployments. More than 500,000 individuals have now had two or more deployments. And I mentioned that the most important factor is the amount of trauma. These people are going to be psychiatrically and medically sicker. It's common that I see in practice someone who comes back from a first deployment and they might be sub-threshold for a diagnosis of PTSD, or they might have PTSD but are pretty much able to cope with the symptoms. When I see them return from a subsequent deployment, I see them completely unable to function in civilian society. This is a list of alterations in neurophysiology that occur in PTSD. These are things we can measure that are different. And the point here is that PTSD is a war wound, no less than is a shrapnel wound. Alterations in stress hormones, neurotransmitter systems, the immune system itself is depressed, and a number of neuroanatomic and neurophysiologic differences. If you look at the major stress hormone system, this is the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Just thinking about the bottom of the axis, the adrenal gland. The inside part of the gland, the medulla, produces norepinephrine, what we know as adrenaline. And this is your fight or flight response. Well, norepinephrine is increased in people with PTSD. You can measure it in the blood, in the urine, in the cerebrospinal fluid. The outside part of the adrenal, the cortex, produces cortisol. And this is like a cortisone injection for pain or hydrocortisone cream that you put on a skin inflammation. Cortisol quiets things down. And the basal levels of cortisol are low in PTSD. So the whole system is out of whack. So norepinephrine is the revving up hormone. Cortisol is the quieting down hormone. Normally, they're in balance, and in PTSD, they're very much out of balance. Another way to look at this is neuroanatomically. The key structure is the amygdala, which is your emotional brain. the seat of very powerful emotions, namely anger and fear. And this is the response to a threat. It's the fear circuitry in the brain. The amygdala outputs to your heart to increase your heart rate, your blood vessels to increase your blood pressure, and your muscles to fight or flight, whichever you're going to choose. And you get sights and sounds and smells that come in and they trigger this response. In PTSD, the amygdala is hypersensitized and hyperactive. It fires off too easily and then doesn't settle back down again. The other two structures here, the frontal cortex and the hippocampus, are other brain structures that are brakes, essentially. They have reciprocal inhibitory connections, and they put brakes on the amygdala. Also in PTSD, these inhibitory systems are deficient. So the amygdala is hyperactive, the frontal cortex and the hippocampus are not inhibiting it properly. This is just some quick anatomy. This red nucleus at the center is your amygdala, deep in the center of the brain. There's one on both sides. And this is your frontal cortex. The frontal lobe is the key counterpart to amygdala. That's your thinking brain. So patients will ask, why do I get so angry? What's wrong with my memory? The amygdala, it's not technically accurate, but it's the right idea. We call it the reptile brain or the dinosaur brain. It's the emotional response, fear, anger, fight, or flight. The frontal lobe is your executive function. It's the thinking brain. It's your cognitive response, working memory, attention, and carrying out tasks. So the amygdala is hyperactive, and people with PTSD have trouble getting their frontal lobe to be online. So they're in battle mode all the time, and the frontal lobe is offline. The Army has a really good word. We call it hypervigilance in medicine. The Army calls it battle mind. And I think this is an excellent term to use with patients. In a dangerous situation, you don't want to sit around and think. You want to act immediately using your amygdala and bypassing your frontal lobe. In PTSD, the brain acts like you're in a dangerous situation all the time. The amygdala is hyperactive and the frontal lobe functions poorly. Anger and poor concentration are related and both part of hyperarousal. So I don't really have time to talk, except for very briefly, about this. There's no specific medication for PTSD. We tend to try to treat the prominent symptoms and the comorbidity. We use a variety of medications. I've been doing some work on the alpha adrenergic antagonist prazosin for suppression of trauma nightmares that has been promising. An interesting one on this list are anticonvulsant medications that are used to treat epilepsy. They help to quiet down that hyperactive amygdala so it doesn't fire off so easily. In terms of psychotherapy, it's very challenging and very rewarding. Education is important, normalizing and validating the trauma. We don't have a medication for guilt, but it's often very amenable to psychotherapy. Group therapy is very important, and things like relaxation training and mindfulness training. Some effective therapies, exposure therapy, cognitive therapy, behavioral activation. I have time to tell you one story from Iraq. This is a checkpoint in Tal Afar in the north. These are children who were driving toward the checkpoint in the back seat. Their parents were in the front seat. The soldiers here yelled at the car to stop and did everything they were supposed to do. No one will ever know why the car didn't stop. They opened fire. The parents were killed instantly. What you're seeing in this photograph are children awash with the blood of their own parents. Think about what these children will feel about Americans, and think about how these soldiers are going to live with this event for the rest of their lives. They will likely get PTSD, and in any case, they'll be tortured by it. There are many similarities between Iraq and Vietnam. Not knowing who the enemy is an important factor. This leads to a lot of PTSD. Feeling like you've been lied to. There's no front line anymore. Everywhere is dangerous. Inadequate training or preparedness for some, like in the reserve or the guard. And I've mentioned civilian casualties and friendly fire. There are also some important differences. The homecoming that Iraq veterans are getting is very, very supportive. If we've learned only one thing from our Vietnam experience, it's that we need to support our troops regardless of what our political opinions are. We understand readjustment problems and traumatic stress disorders far, far better, and the hope is that with early recognition, we'll be able to treat the problem, and it'll be better this time. Beyond the individual, there are the effects on families. More marital problems, behavioral problems in children, family violence that is generational. This is a very important study that looks at social problems in the entire population. This is not just veterans. And what we find is that 9% of all unemployment in the country is attributable to combat exposure. 8% of all divorce or separation is attributable to combat exposure. 21% of all spouse or partner abuse. The cost of war is often measured in the physical destruction, in the number of dead, but probably worse is the psychological and spiritual toll. This cost takes generations to heal. It cripples and perverts whole societies. New York Times war correspondent Chris Hedges. Then, in addition to the costs of the medical care that we're providing, there's another cost, which is disability benefits. A U.S. veteran who's 100% disabled and unemployable receives compensation payments right now from the VA of $2,471 per month. Over a 50-year period, this could total $1.5 million without any adjustment for inflation. So here's the big picture. The health costs of the war to the U.S. We've heard there are approaching 4,000 dead. And this does not include the more than 1,000 civilian contractors that have died. There are more than 60,000 wounded, injured, and medically ill, so an order of magnitude greater. And then go up one more order of magnitude, we're talking on the order of 300,000 psychiatric casualties. This has been, the lifetime costs of this have been estimated by Harvard economists at up to $660 billion. That's greater than the military operational cost of the war. And we've mentioned some of the social issues. We can barely even think of how to put a dollar figure on these. Lastly, it's hard for me to talk about the U.S. side without briefly mentioning the costs to the Iraqi side. More than 1 million civilian deaths. This is extrapolation from the Roberts study. Widespread malnutrition, infectious disease, tremendous refugee crisis, 2.2 million refugees in surrounding countries, another 2.2 million internally displaced. The destruction, entire destruction of the healthcare system, which 20 years ago was likely the best healthcare system in the entire Arab world. And if you just look at the doctors, more than half the doctors have fled the country, and 2,000 of them have been killed. So if you just think what happens when virtually everyone in the country has PTSD, and you just look at the individual symptoms and you compound them, anger outbursts, emotional numbing, hypervigilance, distrust and paranoia, preoccupation with the enemy, isolation and despair, you can see that PTSD serves as an engine to perpetuate war. So I'll finish with two references that I want to give you that I think are excellent. The National Center for PTSD, ncptsd.org, has lots of fact sheets and guides for military personnel, families, clinicians, and the Army's, the Walter Reed Group's Battle Mind training. You can actually see their training videos streaming online. They're really well done, and they're very helpful for returning veterans. And I'll conclude with a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. Veterans have experience that makes them the light at the tip of the candle, illuminating the roots of war and the way to peace. Thank you.
We are running a little late, so we are going to hold the questions to the end. Evan has graciously stated that he can stay a little bit later after the end of the session, and this room will not be in use after the session. So for those of you who aren't coming to the Peace Caucus business meeting at 6, you can speak to the folks if there's more questions. I'd next like to introduce you to an Iraq War vet, my friend from IVAW, whose name is not in the program, Jeff Millard. That would be Jeff.
I don't have any fancy presentation, but so that's why I turned up the lights so you can actually see me. I spent 13 months in Iraq, 9 years in the U.S. military. The last 9 months of my military career I spent AWOL as a war resister. I refused to return to a second tour in Iraq, not really for any psychological reasons, much more for political reasons. Although when I decided to make my decision, or when I decided to go AWOL and not return to my unit, technically unexcused absence from where I was, my first sergeant said, we're going to mark you AWOL whether you show up or not. We don't give a shit. So it made the decision pretty easy. But every day before then, when I had to put on a uniform, every time that I had to lace up my boots, I was having panic attacks. I couldn't breathe barely. It was just causing me a lot of stress to even do that, to put myself in that same situation again. So it was a pretty easy decision when it came time to. And I left, and I took my life back. And I left the military in July of last year, though I got an honorable discharge in May of this year. I got an honorable discharge because I started to work on war resistor campaigns. I made the Army realize that it was better letting me go than to try and fight me. And so that it was actually a fun experience to do that. When I got the paperwork for it, I was just getting done working on another resistance campaign that we won and had huge media attention, Adam Kokesh. And I got home and I saw this big envelope from the military and I went, oh yeah, it's on now. It's my turn. And I opened it up and it's a fucking certificate for an honorable discharge. I was actually kind of pissed off about that, but it happens. But when, you know, I have to say, first off, too, is that there's a misconception in this country that was present in the last presentation, and that is that veterans of this war get treated well. And I don't know where the fuck this comes from at all. And the other misconception that goes hand in hand with that was that the anti-war movement were the ones mistreating Vietnam veterans, and that's bullshit, too. It's just not historically the case. It's a great book called The Spitting Image, which chronicles that quite well. The fact of the matter is, in both cases, it's conservative people that fucking mistreat vets, mainly anti-war vets. Vietnam Veterans Against the War was the driving force behind the anti-war movement in Vietnam, and Iraq Veterans Against the War is the driving force behind the anti-Iraq war movement. Plain and simple, it's being led by veterans. The places that were not accepted as general society. And that hasn't changed from Vietnam to today. What, because you fucking throw a sticker on your truck, a fucking magnet that says you support the troops, that means it? Read those stickers. Okay? It's not support our troops, it's support the troops. You don't even take ownership of the U.S. military anymore. Just because you throw a sticker on your car doesn't alleviate you from actually taking care of troops. And the fact is the sheer wording on that, using troops and not talking about veterans. The fact is that when we come home, we're not troops. This language is used on purpose. The language is used to make sure that we never actually get to the problems at hand. We like to talk about troops who is like this ambiguous force over there doing something. Nobody knows a troop, but we all know veterans. There's veterans in all of our communities. And nobody's talking about supporting veterans. Every Christmas since I've been home from Iraq, I've been at the VA hospital talking to veterans. I've yet to see a conservative organization ever there. I've seen Veterans for Peace, Iraq Veterans Against the War, Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Those are the organizations I see on holidays at the VA. So when I hear this, it really pisses me off. And so there's probably a little bit of anger shit going on. So sorry about that little outburst there. Go on to my actual talk now. We'll move on. And the big thing that I did want to talk about was that war best. I spend most of my time talking about my experiences. I travel all around, I'm on the Hill, I work as a reporter. I'm extremely functioning. Over the weekend, I slept about 4 hours. I was emailing back and forth with some folks at VVAW in Chicago at like 4 a.m. the other day, talking about going there for a visit, which I leave tomorrow morning. So the fact is that even amongst the best case scenario, there's stuff going on that you never see. It's just very common. And I worked my job, I started in the military in 1998. I went in for a large number of reasons, but the biggest reason is honor and respect. When I was growing up, I was a poor kid in Buffalo, New York, and my grandfather, who was a World War II vet, died when I was a kid, and I remember being just poor white trash and seeing seven soldiers coming out and paying him that level of respect, folding the flag, firing the weapons, and it was just really an emotional and heartfelt thing to me. In a neighborhood where respect was not easy to come by, this poor old white guy got this level of respect. And I wanted some of that. That was a big reason of joining the military. And I feel really disrespected by this country now, because they send you into a war that you never should have gone to. And then when you come home, you get a 6-month waiting list at the VA. You know, I've got friends that are on a waiting list for PTSD care. Now me, I don't go to the VA for PTSD care. They ask me every time I go in, do you want to see somebody? And I go, no, I don't want to be on a waiting list. I've been involved with a peer counseling organization called Vets for Vets. That's how I got involved in knowing other veterans. And I wandered around for a long time lost without other vets. And it was meeting other veterans and knowing that I wasn't alone that made the difference for me. And like I said, I'm the best case scenario. I went in as an explosives expert in the Army, did explosives for about 6 years. Then I moved into infantry. And when I went to Iraq, I thought I was going as an infantryman. Plain and simple, just like the rest of my unit. Well, I was selected to go with a general. I worked in a TOC, classified area, and I put together these classified briefings pretty much every day. We got mortared several times a day. That was the reality of life for us in Iraq. And when I got home, I thought, I'm done. I'm going to just go back to college and finish my degree. And that didn't really happen. 2 days after I got home from Iraq and I was still on active duty, I got a call from a friend of mine, or it was actually the night that I got home from Iraq, I get a call and my cell phone's back on from a friend of mine back home, and she says, hey, I'm doing this anti-war speech and I know that you don't really like the war, would you come out to our event and just say a couple words? And I said, all right, I'll do it just this once. Just this once never damn works. Why? Like, I should have learned in the military that if you volunteer for something, you are going all the way with that, whatever it is. And so 2 days later, I did my first anti-war speech, and that turned into 5, and it turned into doing this every day. And now I'm working with Iraq Veterans Against the War here in D.C. as the Washington, D.C. chapter president, but we're also working on opening up a policy center. We're calling it the Iraq Veterans Policy Center. Right now, even those who really care about veterans on the Hill do not craft policy from a veteran's perspective. And so what we're trying to do is interject veterans into the policy process by bridging personal relationships between policymakers and veterans. We plan on having a space that we can open up and have veterans come live here from anywhere between 2 weeks and 2 years to create personal relationships with policymakers so that when Senator X wants to have a hearing on depleted uranium or wants to write a bill on depleted uranium, they're not thinking about depleted uranium in these grandiose terms, but they're thinking Johnny from the IVPC, who has degenerative spinal disease or who has various other depleted uranium-related problems. And by the way, in case you guys haven't heard of depleted uranium, it makes Agent Orange look like Kool-Aid. The stuff is already killing Iraq vets. And what's going to happen with it in the future is drastic. So you have all these mental and physical issues that we come back home and deal with. But how do you deal with that in a situation where people don't want to talk about it? They don't want to talk about the war. In large percentage, the people in the United States don't want to talk about the war. They want to talk about Britney Spears and this and that. I was on Bill O'Reilly a few weeks ago, and I was supposed to talk about the phony soldier comment by Rush Limbaugh. And Bill asked me, and I said, I don't care. I think the Senate wasted its time by voting on it. Just like the Senate wasted its time on voting on Move On. Why the hell are we talking about all these fools talking about the war? Let's talk about the war. And so I'm going to leave you real quick with something, a way to go forward. Because I feel like a lot of times I get up and speak and people get up and speak and they tell you these things and I can tell you a million sad stories and walk out and like you're ready to kill yourself. But I can leave you with something to go forward with. And that is to truly make sure that you have change. Take the little yellow ribbon off your fucking car and throw it away, because for most vets, that just pisses us off. Like, I hate that shit. Most of my friends hate that shit. Even a lot of people I know that support the war hate that shit. Take them fucking things off. Throw them in the garbage. And with the money that you're going to buy your second and third one, because motherfuckers who have those have like six of them on their fucking cars. So with the money you were going to get your next one with, put that to good use. Go down to your local VA. Talk to a vet. Buy him a cup of coffee. And listen. Don't talk. Listen. Find that vet in your neighborhood. Take him out for a cup of coffee. And don't talk. Listen. Because as my mentor said, there's only so much learning you can do with your mouth open. And right now, America needs to do more learning than it does talking. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. For a perspective on how this war is impacting families here in the United States, we have someone from Military Families Support. This is Elizabeth Frederick. Military families, speak out.
My name is Elizabeth Frederick, and as she said, I am a member of Military Families Speak Out, which is a national organization of military families who are opposed to the war in Iraq. And I just want to spend a couple of minutes today talking about PTSD and especially the impact it has on military families. But most importantly, I would like to reemphasize that all of the pain and the suffering that these soldiers and their families have endured and continue to endure should never have been felt. The war in Iraq was waged under false pretenses, and the American public was fed information. Now, I know a lot of people now like to say that it doesn't do any good to continue arguing that point now that the war is well underway, but I disagree with that, and I do so because to stop arguing that point is tantamount to shrugging our shoulders and accepting things for what they are and leaving open the chance that such a thing could happen again. And a war based on lies is nothing to shrug off or dismiss once it has begun. 3,855 American soldiers have lost their lives because of the mistakes, miscalculations, and immoral decisions of a few leaders. And thousands more have been wounded and will struggle for years to heal. Every single American, including those of us in this room, has a responsibility to demand accountability and answers. And to stop demanding such things is the same thing as to say, it just doesn't matter to me. To military families, we can't stop caring because it's our family members' lives that are at risk. Our soldiers go where they're sent, whether they agree or disagree with the reasons for going or not. And it's up to the citizen activists at home to demand change and to push for it relentlessly. There's been a lot of talk about how the majority of Americans don't bear the burden of this war, and that's very true. But pushing for change is one way to get involved and to take on some of the burden and to acknowledge that human suffering without cause is not something that we as a country will stand idly by and watch. In order to push people to change, you have to give them a reason to do it, which is why I'm here today, just to share a few stories and to give you a reason to get involved. I'm just one person, but I represent thousands of families who have suffered as a result of this war. And without the help of people outside of the military, this war can't be stopped and these problems can't be adequately addressed, which is why we need your involvement. Not every family in my organization has a soldier who suffers with PTSD, but many of them do, and most of us have absolutely no idea how to adapt or help their soldier. The acronym is really clinical, and it doesn't do a very good job of describing the 24-hour struggle to return to normalcy. And it doesn't do a very good job to try to quell the fear that you forever lost the person you said goodbye to when they deployed, or the anxiety of figuring out what you as one individual can do to help them. For many families, I think they have this idea that the hardest part is getting through the deployment and just making sure that the soldier comes home safe. And for a lot of families, that's exactly the case. And when the soldier comes home, it's a joyful reunion and life goes on. But for thousands of others, the war continues to be brought into the home. It's not left out on the battlefield. It shows up in nightmares and in sleepless nights. It shows up in excessive drinking and erratic behavior and sometimes violent mood swings. And sometimes the situation is much worse. Kevin and Joyce Lucy are two members of Military Family Speak Out, and they tried to get help for their son Jeff, who returned from Iraq in 2003. He was even at one point involuntarily committed to a VA facility, even though they discharged him 4 days later. And unfortunately, Jeff didn't get the help that he needed. And in 2004, Jeff's dad walked down to their basement to find him hanging from a garden hose. Jeff was 23 years old when he died. There was another woman who I'm good friends with who struggled for years to get the husband that she knew back after his deployment, yet their marriage is on the verge of ending. They don't fight, they don't harbor any ill will towards one another. In fact, he actually helped her move her things into a storage space and drove her to the airport on her flight out of town. And when they first separated, I asked her what happened. I thought things were getting better, and she said he just wouldn't get help. You know, after all, he's an officer, and people shine on those things. Officers are supposed to be in command of others. They're not supposed to go and get help and show weakness on the battlefield. So she went to counseling alone, trying to find ways to help him to cope. But her efforts weren't enough to bring him back to his old self. And day by day, he slipped away a little more, and he pushed her away, pushed her out of his life. And when she finally asked him, "What else can I do?" he just looked at her and he said, "I don't care what you do or where you go as long as you don't stay here." Another mother has been estranged from her son since he left home. He almost killed himself in a drunken driving accident a few years ago, but even that wasn't enough to push him to go and get help. He still lives on the streets the majority of the time, and while his mother tries desperately to get him to come back home, she goes to sleep every single night wondering if the police are going to knock at her door telling her that she lost her son, not in Iraq, but on the streets of America. There are many other stories of young lives that have been lost and families torn apart, and not always by suicide, but by the overall impact of PTSD and the effects that that has on their relationship. How long do people wait for things to get better before finally calling it quits? And what's the difference between being a good supportive military spouse and being an enabler? What happens when the family members start losing sleep and developing their own unhealthy habits? And what do you do when no matter how hard you beg and you plead for someone to get help, they simply won't do it? These are the questions that many military families are faced with, and questions that family readiness groups and the VA, for all their good intentions, don't have very good answers to. We trained ourselves to withstand the deployment and to welcome our soldiers home, not knowing we would also be enlisted to help rebuild their emotional and mental frameworks in the months and years to follow. We're really ordinary people caught up in a really awful situation. We're looking for a way out and a way back to the lives that we had before the Iraq War began. The burden's not all on the VA. No one, not the government, nor family members, can force a returning veteran to get help. However, on the other hand, the fact remains that those in charge weren't prepared for the onslaught of soldiers coming home for these problems. The administration was more concerned with starting a war than with thinking about the consequences or how to take care of those who made it home alive but need years of help to recover from the experience. The bottom line is that had the war not begun, none of these lives would have been damaged. It's our view that the war needs to end. It was wrong at the beginning, and it's wrong now, and PTSD shouldn't have to affect any more families. Instead, we should be focusing on healing the wounded veterans that we have now and repairing the damage that has already been done. It's time that the administration stop using the lives of our loved ones to fight a war that we know is wrong. We each have a responsibility to push for that change in any way we can, and I urge you to remember that.
Thank you. In VVAW, we have a saying, it goes something like this: honor the dead and fight like hell for the living. Our next speaker, to give us the perspective of the effects of this horrible war on labor, is Denise Lombard. Thank you, Denise.
Hello. Thank you for coming to this workshop today. My name is Denise Lombard, and I'm with an organization called U.S. Labor Against the War, and we formed before the war started. We're individual union members, labor councils, locals, a few internationals, all coming together to try to get the labor movement into the anti-war camp and to use its power to end the war. And we've had some pretty good results with that. We forced the AFL-CIO to take the first anti-war stand in history in July of 05, where they passed a resolution calling for rapid withdrawal of troops. It wasn't everything we wanted, but it was a lot more than anybody expected. My role within U.S. Labor Against the War has been to chair the International Solidarity Task Force. And what that is we've sent a delegation to Iraq and made contact with unions, and then we've had two tours of Iraqi labor leaders here in the United States, and I've worked on both of those. And part of the reason that we feel that's really important work is because it brings the true face. Too loud? Thank you, sorry. Somebody should have said something. It brings the true face of the realities of the impact of the war on Iraqis to the United States, and it makes it very, you know, real when people meet face to face with Iraqis and hear about their experiences, and a lot of stereotypes get broken down. So the bottom line of what labor, you know, how the war in Iraq has affected labor is that every dollar spent on the war is a dollar less for America's working families. Very basic, we know it. You know, the huge billions and billions of dollars that go to war means that money for health care, jobs, and education is lessened. To quote Dwight D. Eisenhower, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. And we could add to that those who suffer physical or mental ailments and are not treated. The amount spent on the Iraq war would pay for health services for 46 million people. How sort of, you know, coincidental that 47 million Americans are uninsured. So, you know, the war, all the money spent on the war could insure all of the uninsured people in this country. And health care for all, not just union members, but all working people, is a huge priority for the labor movement. In fact, we're launching a huge campaign for universal health care in the coming months. Brooke Sunkett, Vice President of Communication Workers of America, who's also a Vietnam vet and a member of U.S. Labor Against the War, has seen firsthand how funding for the war has torn big holes in the social safety net. He represents public sector workers across the country, and he's seen massive cutbacks in services like daycare, care for the elderly and the disabled. And looking at New Orleans, he says that if there wasn't infrastructure, it just wouldn't have happened the way it did in New Orleans. The social safety net has been so impaired, it's almost useless. And so what about the health impact to Iraq? As some of the previous speakers have mentioned, the healthcare system was very advanced in Iraq before 1990 when the sanctions began. It was the most advanced in the Middle East. Dr. Rashad Zaidan, a physician and advocate for women and children, who I've heard speak a couple of times, said that the situation in Iraq at that time was that many women were educated as doctors and engineers. In fact, where there were 30 or more women in a workplace, there was free child care. There was a huge literacy campaign in 1978 where all people in Iraq between the ages of 15 to 45 went through a literacy program and raised the educational level of the entire society. And so, you know, things were at sort of their peak before the war, and actually before sanctions, before the first war, the Gulf War. And then, you know, everything was cut off. No medical supplies, no technology for healthcare, no books and, you know, medical texts. And so the impact of that was that emergency department started not functioning. Hospitals and healthcare facilities were damaged, and now I'm moving into the war years as well. So 16 years later, Dr. Rashad sees, in 2006, the bodies of 60 women and children a day brought to one hospital in Baghdad. She sees surgery performed by candlelight when the electricity is off. She sees surgery performed without antiseptic. An Iraqi doctor was asked by a journalist, "Isn't democracy bringing technology to the hospitals?" And his reply was that the only technology that's been brought to their hospital is larger cold storage for more dead bodies. And then there's the brain drain. The Iraqi Medical Association estimates that 75% of doctors, pharmacists, and nurses have left their jobs at universities, clinics, and hospitals. And 55% of these have fled abroad. I just wanted to use the focus on children of working people in the United States as well as in Iraq as a sort of a focus for how the war in Iraq is impacting working people and people in general. Clearly, it's an issue, you know, how our children fare, what their health is, what kind of insurance they have is very important to all of us. Today's cost of the war, as of today, just for the Iraq war, approximately $467 billion, would insure 280 million children for 1 year. And then we have the example of SCHIP, the attempted expansion of that program, $35 million over a five-year period. $35 billion over a five-year period, which, as we all know, was vetoed by Bush. And at the same time, he turns around and asks for a $42.3 billion supplemental to add on to the ordinary and regular funds allotted for the war in Iraq. So that's a pretty stark comparison. The war, obviously, in Iraq takes a huge toll on children's physical and mental health, and it will have a huge impact on the future of Iraq. Just think about children growing up in a world where they are constantly fearful, with huge psychological scars. I mean, you know, this is even assuming that Iraq was to heal in the future, which will take, you know, who knows how long, many, many years. Iraqi children today have the lowest rate of survival to age 5 in the whole world. 1 in 8 dies between the ages of 1 and 5, many from combat or disease, and many from treatable infections, like respiratory infections and dysentery-type infections. 270,000 children in Iraq have not had vaccinations since the start of the war. Malnutrition, according to UNICEF, is at 4.5 million in Iraq. 1 in 10 children is underweight. 1 in 5 is short for their age because of malnutrition. One real problem, I think, for the health of children in Iraq is that they're confined to home. They basically are prisoners of their families. And this means that children don't get to play. During the 90s, this is a quote from an economist in Bakuba, which is a town north of Baghdad. During the 90s, they were malnourished, but they could find a place to play in the streets. Nowadays, they cannot even get out of their homes because of the violence. One of the two Iraqi trade union leaders that came in June was the only woman leader of a union in Iraq. Her name's Hashmiya Mohsen Hussein, and she's the head of the Electricity Workers Union. And she has an 8-year-old son. And because she's a woman union leader and the political Islamists don't like her to be, you know, active as a woman, she not only received death threats to herself, but threats that her child be kidnapped when he was 6 years old. As a result of this, she keeps him inside all the time. He doesn't get to play in the streets and go out and play with other children. And she says it's his destiny. You know, she has to accept that. And, you know, nobody likes to keep the kid in all the time. And this is throughout all of Iraq. But it's better than a bullet in the head. The kids generally go out and play just on like a holiday or something. Hashmiya's son, Muhammad, said that he didn't want to go to the local playground on this particular holiday. And she asked him, why not? And he said, because the terrorists kill people when they're in groups. And this is from an 8-year-old child. So he likes to go after the holiday when there's only, you know, a few people out. Not going to school for security reasons or school closures. In some areas, up to 90% of children are not attending school. Since 2005, 125 children have been killed and 107 injured in attacks on schools. Quoting Oxfam, 92% of children have learning impediments attributable to a climate of fear. So being raised in a climate of fear and violence leads to vulnerability to manipulation and brainwashing into helping militias and insurgents. Even though they might have money and good ideas, which I've read that certain areas do to organize sports or entertainment activities, they don't do it and can't do it because it's not safe. Prostitution is on the rise. Young girls are obliged to contribute to family incomes. You know, unemployment is up to 70% in much of Iraq. So even though there's like evidently plenty of employment for U.S. contractors, there's no work for Iraqis. So, you know, young girls are forced into prostitution, which of course leads to an increase in sexual and gender-based violence, sexually transmitted diseases, and of course major psychological impacts. So I think, and one thing that was very interesting when Hashmiya and I spoke was she said she was a very dynamic, powerful woman, but she at one point said to me, you know, there is no hope in Iraq. And that's like really stuck with me because no hope in Iraq. I mean, the people feel this incredible sense of hopelessness. Going from a very developed, hopeful society, you know, yeah, Saddam Hussein was at the top of it, but, you know, it functioned and the economy was working and you know, people were working and education was working. And, you know, the garbage was working, electricity was working, water purification was working, to a situation today where none of those things are working. And all of, you know, so many millions of Iraqis, especially the more educated Iraqis, have left the country. Where's the hope, you know? And she said that she wanted to, when her son was threatened with being kidnapped, she thought maybe she should step back and, you know, give her job to somebody else. But then she said, well, if we just give in to fear and hopelessness, you know, there's no future for Iraq. And so she wanted to be, you know, an example for women in Iraq and continue to be a leader. So what can we do to help Iraqis have hope? I think I just want to echo what Jeff said about each and every one of us have a responsibility as American citizens. You know, this is our country that's doing this to devastating another country and another people. And there are so many ways we can be more active than we are. You know, more letters written, more phone calls to your congresspeople. That's the easiest thing. But there are many organizations, many niches, many veterans that could be listened to, you know. Find your niche, find your vehicle to do your part to end this war. Join U.S. Labor Against the War. I think it's so important to bring the reality of what workers and people of Iraq, I mean, there's a whole vast Everybody is not a Shia or a Sunni in Iraq. You know, there's this vast working class that are, you know, secular, democratic. They want their country back. They want what you and I want. And I think it's important for us to become sensitized to the reality of war and not let the media and the, you know, the hugeness of the task overwhelm us and make us passive on the question. So, and the struggle will continue into the future. Even when the war is over, there will be years of work that will need to be done to help Iraq heal, not only directly, but also through challenging our government to take responsibility for the results of its actions. So thank you very much for hearing me out today.
Thank you all for coming. We will, in just a moment, open this up for questions. I don't think there's anyone in this country that has not been directly affected from the war in Iraq. If there's anyone here who thinks they have not been directly affected by the war in Iraq, see me later. And for the rest of us, I think that the calls to action are clear. APHA has taken some really important actions. It was hard for me when I first came to APHA to think of the doings of the Governing Council as important to me, a clinical nurse practitioner. But the fact is, we heard this morning, earlier today in another session, that the very fact that APHA is against the war in Iraq allowed a major university to mount the wonderful photo exhibit that is now mounted over at the AFL-CIO, unembedded. And if you have not seen the unembedded photos, please go see them. They're open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Through Thursday, and they are amazing. It's an amazing emotional impact. Bring your friends. You do not need the orange card to get into the AFL-CIO. You can actually bring, the general public is actually allowed. So are there any questions for any, yes, ma'am? And somebody who has worked with VVAW for 41 years, just being there and having open ears is a really important thing. It is important for vets to talk to vets. I can't stress enough that vets talking to vets is the reason that there is such a diagnosis as PTSD in the DSM. And that is thanks to Hai Shaitan, a non-veteran psychiatrist who listened to vets. But there is also a need for vets to know that we do not think of them as creatures from another planet, or as aliens that are to be feared, which was a big part of, if you remember, those of you old enough to remember TV in the Vietnam era, the crazy veteran killing someone happened 3 times a night on 3 major TV stations. At least we're not laying that on the Iraq vets yet. And the more of us as civilians who open our hearts and our ears, the more effective our work will be. Yes, go ahead.
Generally speaking, for PTSD in both military and civilian populations, most people get better, and there is some group, say 15 to 25%, somewhere in there, who develop these chronic cases of PTSD, and we don't know why. There are a lot of factors, but sometimes we think it's important. Maybe we should be studying the people who don't get PTSD, who do get better, so we can understand what the process is. In terms of the issue of sort of hatred of the enemy and how that impacts people, it turns out that that is not what the important factor is. The important factor in whether people get better is their sense of personal safety. And this has been studied particularly in the South African population. There have been a very interesting study associated with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and also in the former Yugoslavia in various populations. And so psychologically, someone's sense of personal safety, that's what's critical. The hatred toward the enemy really goes away. The state that heard described in Iraq of no safety would suggest that that's really going to perpetuate the problem.
Yes, back here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll let Jeff take this in just 1 second, so he's getting up. But yesterday in the Military Times, which is a paper that everyone in the military gets, there's an ad from a guy named Bill Perry, and he is Mr. Let's Get Our Discharge Issues and Get Back to Our Real Life go-to guy in the world, and he's out in Chicago. And so the military has actually put our ad in the Military Times to help people start getting their lives back before they even get home. And now I'll give it to Jeff.
Yeah, the interesting thing about the Appeal for Redress is that, A, it was started by members of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Another thing, Iraq Veterans Against the War began in the summer of 2003 with 7 members. We've grown more than 100-fold in less than 3 years. Of the 1.5 million veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, 3/4 of them remain on active duty. So if you want to organize veterans, you have to go to active duty because most of the veterans from Iraq aren't technically even veterans yet, which is another reason why some of the numbers that we're seeing in the presentation given are so amazing in that it may seem low, but when you compare how many veterans are even eligible for VA care because they're not even off active duty yet, it suddenly makes that number very different. Secondary to that is the largest growing, or the fastest growing segment of Iraq Veterans Against the War is active duty service personnel. We have 2 active duty chapters now, about to be a third and a fourth are both ready to stand up, just a matter of making it happen. Fort Drum was the first. Fort Meade, just outside of Washington, D.C., which is where the NSA is located, so the NSA now has an active chapter of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Camp Pendleton in California, Marine Base, is ready to start an active duty chapter of Iraq Veterans Against the War. So the big thing, really, is getting members of the military to talk about it, because we've found talking to active duty service personnel that every once in a while there's a loudmouth like me who's talking shit all the time, but usually when they talk about the war and their opposition to it, it's whispered. It's something very whispered. When we started the chapter at the NSA at Fort Meade, it was something really highly contested. These are all people with top secret security clearances who work in intelligence jobs who literally work for the NSA. And it was like, can we really do this? Are we going to, what are the repercussions to this? And trying to get people to stop whispering and start talking about the war among service members is very important, especially when they're opposed to it. So we're here in Washington, D.C., are beginning what we're calling a You Are Not Alone campaign. It's a silent campaign, it's a flyer campaign, where we're going to have a simple flyer that says You Are Not Alone. We're putting up 1,000 of them on Sunday. And we're hoping to cover Washington, D.C., Walter Reed, the Pentagon, and all 5 of the military installations surrounding Washington, D.C., to have this You Are Not Alone message sent to them, because active duty service personnel right now that oppose the war make up the majority of the military, according to multiple polls, but yet they don't want to talk about it. The first thing that we've come up with to break down that barrier is to get people talking, make sure the GIs know that they're not alone. We feel this way. I wasn't crazy when I decided that the war was wrong. I was the same one, and it was the fuckers above me who work at the Pentagon that said that it was right that are crazy motherfuckers.
GI resistance, by the way, is not new to the Iraq War. In memorial of a recently departed friend of ours named Dave Klein, there was a lot of GI resistance that he and the others of the Vietnam era modeled. And we lost David a couple of weeks ago, but he's still with us. And if you all don't get your butts out of the seats and get active, he's likely to come kick your ass. Anyone else with questions? Yes, sir.
I could, but technically I can't because it's not really clear, actually, to be totally honest with you. The military works under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ. It's an archaic justice system with a 95% conviction rate. It is not set up under the premise that you are assumed innocent until proven guilty. It has a 95% conviction rate. Also, we are the only military in the entire world who functions under a military law during peacetime. And while there is an occupation of Iraq going on, technically we have never declared war in Iraq, therefore technically not at war. So we still are technically, according to our constitution, not at war. But the fact of the matter remains, it's an archaic system, and it does take away most rights from a service member. However, those who can take away those rights are generally in their chain of command, and so it's up to the chain of command. When I left the military, my chain of command made the decision that it was not worth the fight. They weren't going to give me a platform, a soapbox. They weren't going to give me a court-martial. And it was easier for them to give me an honorable discharge. Then you've got morons like General Dubik out in Fort Lewis who have court-martialed two war resistors, making Fort Lewis the epicenter of GI resistance on the entire West Coast because he opposed two people who simply wanted to get out of the military. And we made a deal of it. And so when we find people that are being challenged by their chain of command, there's a gentleman right now who works at Walter Reed, and he simply wrote a letter to his inside of chain of command saying that there are problems at Walter Reed and then outlined solutions for those problems. And he is being punished because of it. He has been held in now for 3 months past his contract. He is not being allowed to resign his commission. He has been given terrible work hours. And so we're going to a few influential congressional leaders to attempt to do this quietly. And if they cannot do it quietly, we will do it very loudly. And we will make sure that General Schumacher, who is in this gentleman's chain of command, does not get the third star President Bush has put him in for. So the responsibility of us, not just Iraq Veterans Against the War, but everyone, is that if you want to see GI resistance, when a GI resists, you need to be there. When General Dubik out in Fort Lewis decided to court-martial Lieutenant Watata, there was a huge movement of civilians to make sure. They called General Dubik. They wrote him letters. They said, what are you doing? They called the military. We put up numbers for the entire military chain of command saying, do not prosecute. Allow this lieutenant to get out of the military. Didn't happen. They court-martialed him. Ended in a mistrial. You know, this is the type of thing that we need to make sure that we voice. We do not allow GI resistors to be silenced because of an archaic justice system. We need to make sure that we go to where the silence is and bring the noise.
And when you see these guys, even guys who have gotten out of the military, even guys who have been discharged, honorably discharged, you may see guys in uniform at demonstrations who are still technically in the ready reserve, who are still in line for sanctions. These are really brave guys. You know, these are guys that we need to give our respect to, and I do. And, you know, just remember, the consequences can be dire. IVAW has a website, ivaw.org. VVAW has a website, vvaw.org. We're just real original here. Those websites are linked to a bunch of others. If you need anything from resistance ability to you know people who need their discharge upgraded, or you have friends, or you just want to get involved, my name is on the VVAW website. I'm Ann Hirschman, Annie Hirschman on that website. And Jeff is on the IVAW website. And MFSO.org, MilitaryFamiliesSpeakOut.org, for the military families. If you have friends who are saying, well, we can't really just pull everyone out, ask them whether they would rather just leave everyone in. Just, yeah, we can, and we should, and we've got to. Thank you all very much for coming. Thank our panelists.